All right, thanks. So there shouldn't be, in principle, any distinction between engineering software for one thing and engineering software for something else. I mean, there's this whole field of software engineering, and then, well, if they're doing their jobs, you just take whatever the software engineering experts tell you to do, and then you do that for crypto, right? And then you've got your crypto software engineered, and you're done. For instance, you might start with this nice old paper by Parnas, which is the source of what's called information hiding, one of many basic software engineering principles, which says when you're splitting up your system into pieces, into modules, you could do it as, well, you've got your module for talking to the user, you've got your module for the whole graphical user interface, you've got your module for some other chunk of your program. But he said that's not the right way to divide things up. And he argues that the right way to divide a software system into pieces is to say you make your design decisions and recognize that some of those you're not so sure about. You've got some decisions which are likely to change or might change, and you try to make it as easy as possible to change those decisions by hiding those decisions inside modules. And he says this is the way to divide your system into modules, is that you have a module, some part of your program, which is controlling a certain design decision. And if you want to change that decision, you only have to change that part of your program. A simple example would be, suppose you have a 20-round cipher. Maybe you think that's a good number of rounds for a cipher, or 10 or 16, or, well, yeah, maybe you're not so sure about that. If you write your code so that you have one line of code which says, define the number of rounds in the cipher as 20, and if you properly use that, if you say, anytime you're thinking 20 rounds or you're thinking I need to do something for half the rounds, then you do it in terms of this round, and you test that you're doing it properly if you change 20 to 12 or whatever other number, then, okay, that means it's easy to change. All you have to do is change this one line, and you don't have to go searching for all the 20s and 19s and 10s and derived numbers elsewhere in your code. You just have this one line module which is capturing this number of rounds and hiding that from everything else in your program, if you do it properly. Another example of a software engineering principle, maybe a more complicated one, is that lots of times people will be trying to say, you've got the software you want to write, we'll make it easy for you to write this, and look how easy that is to do. But that's only part of this principle. The second part is to take the wrong things, the things that people don't want you to do, and make it hard to do the wrong things. So the whole principle is you want the right thing to be simple to do and the wrong thing to be complicated to do. And then a crypto example of this is, suppose that you have a message with an authenticator on it. How easy is it to check the authenticator? Often people will try to make that easy. They'll have some simple function call which says, check the authenticator, tell me if it's valid. But what if it's not valid? How easy is it to write the code that does something, says, oops, reject the message because it's not valid? And how easy is it to write wrong code that accidentally accepts an invalid message? Suppose that you don't even call the function to check the authenticator, and you just blithely proceed processing the message. This might sound like a really stupid thing to do, but this is something that people do all the time. This is how real-world crypto software gets broken, is people have just forgotten to check the authenticator. So how can you fix this? Well, you might say, instead of having authentication as the primitive, let's give people authenticated encryption. They're also encrypting, but it's not just that they're being given a more powerful, more useful thing, which also lets them encrypt. It's also that if they want to use the message, they're going to have to decrypt it. If they forget to do the verified decryption call, then it's not just that they're forgetting to check the authenticator, they're getting garbage, which hopefully will be caught by the rest. And you can try to make it even harder for people to forget to check the authenticator on a message. This is, as I said, a harder one than the first principle, and this is something people get wrong all the time. For instance, Cryptlib, Peter Guttmann's crypto library, has in the manual, it says, the sample code used in this manual omits the checking of status values, error codes, for clarity. But when using the library, you should check return values, particularly for critical functions. I'm not sure what an example of a non-critical crypto function would be, but apparently when you're doing something like signature verification or authenticator verification, encryption, decryption, you're supposed to check every one of those lines of code. And the manual, because it's simpler to not check, the manual doesn't bother showing you the checks. And that's a really bad API, but that's how most crypto software looks.
That's both a bad API and a bad manual, then.
Well, the manual is telling you what people will typically do, where it doesn't really care about, you know, are you secure? It just cares about, have you deployed crypto? And it's FIPS certified, so something good is happening there. It's certainly, it's kind of scary if you find a statement like this in your manual. If you find yourself even thinking something like this, you know you're doing something wrong. And then fix that thing. Yeah.
Let's fix. FIPS only does validation.
Oh, shit, a NIST person.
I'm agreeing with you, but I'm going to say
it. Come over here, quick.
FIPS only validates the algorithms, not the protocols.
Yeah, and there's also this amazing race to the bottom that a new feature of FIPS certification, FIPS validation, is that you are no longer allowed, as a U.S. FIPS validation lab, you're no longer allowed to check anything beyond the minimum. This is a new FIPS requirement that you are forced to check only the things that FIPS has as absolute requirements. And you're not even allowed to tell somebody, by the way, we noticed that you're not actually using the crypto properly, but your crypto works great. If you were using it, it would be fine. Common criteria has the lab still allowed to give you that kind of extra information, like you are not using your crypto properly. I could go on with the whole talk about people using crypto badly and general principles of software engineering and what they mean for crypto, but I actually would like to focus on some issues which are specific to crypto, or at least to security. Things that don't show up if you get a general software engineering book, then they won't tell you about these things. I'll start with timing attacks. The classic example here is back in the 1970s, there was an operating system called TEDx, and that operating system had passwords. The passwords were not encrypted or hashed or anything. They were stored, but they were stored in a hopefully secure area on the disk and in memory. And then if you ask the operating system, hey, I'd like to do something that requires authentication, please check this password, there was a feature to check that. And you could, as any user, you could try to authenticate yourself as another user and say, I'd like to do something that user has permission to do. Here's the password for it. And the operating system would say, oh, yeah, that's the right password. Of course, it would have to check. It would have to check the password that you put in versus the secret password that's actually stored. And it would do that one character at a time. So it would check the first character against the first character. Oops, doesn't match. So after one check, it stops. And then, of course, you try BBBBB and CCCC, and eventually you get to, or S, everything AAA, eventually you get to S, and then it checks S versus S. Yes, that matches. And A versus E, no, that doesn't match. So after two comparisons, the system stops. If you see how much time this takes, then with an adaptive chosen plaintext attack, you very quickly determine the secret just by watching how many comparisons, how much time it took for the system to check the password. And people actually did this and broke into other users' accounts on 10x systems. Oops. Now, if you look at IPsec software, for example, software that's checking a 16-byte, typical 128-bit authenticator, then typically the code looks very much like what this 10x code was doing in the 1970s. So you see here that there's a loop of I going from 0 up through 15, and then check is x bracket 0, the same as y bracket 0. If it's not, then immediately return 0. If it is equal, then go on to the next value of I, check x bracket 1 versus y bracket 1, and so on. And if everything matches, you return 1, yes, it's valid. Otherwise, there was that return 0 if anything doesn't match. If you want to make this run in constant time, so the time doesn't allow this easy timing attack, you have to do something that's it's not super complicated, but it's more complicated. Instead of saying, we'll just compare x bracket 0 to y bracket 0, x bracket 1 to y bracket 1, you have to do something with bit operations. And okay, in this room, we're not scared of, you know, ORs and XORs and bit shifts and so on. And yeah, you can see the diff here has to be bigger than an 8-bit variable to make this work. And okay, it's not too hard to figure out, but it's not as simple as just writing the code which says, if each x and y matches, then you're good. If any of them don't match, then immediately stop. So whoever designed this programming language, which is pretty much any programming language, this is in C, but you get the same thing in every popular language, whoever designed this language made it easier to do the wrong thing than to do the right thing. Not much easier, but enough easier that pretty much everybody does the wrong thing. Now, the language designer might say, well, yeah, look, both of these work, because the language designer doesn't care about timing attacks. The language designer cares about making your code work properly, where proper is defined by it has the right output. But in security, our notion of right is stronger than that language designer's notion, and so we tell the language designer, no, this is bad, please fix it, and occasionally there's some effort in Rust, for example, to support some notion of secret values that can't be leaked through timing, but this is very experimental, and basically no programming languages support this. So you get mistakes that continue and continue and continue, and people continue having variable time code for doing very simple operations. For instance, if you look at the reference software for Caesar submissions, for instance, the clock software, is Tetsu here? Maybe, then you find the following software, which I just noticed this, I didn't put it in myself, which looks very much like that code up there. You go I0 up to however many bytes are in an authenticator, check tag bracket I versus something at the end of the ciphertext. And if it's not equal, you return whatever. If it is all equal, then you return something. So there's variable time software, which is a little easier to write than the right software here. The wrong software is easier to write than the right software. So that's, of course, what people end up doing, which does allow your secret information to be leaked through timing. The attack is just you try your authenticator starting with a 0, and then try with a 1, et cetera, and whichever first byte takes longest, that's the correct first byte, and then you move on to the second byte, and so on. And within a few thousand plain text, within a few thousand authenticator tries, you've figured out the correct authenticator. Now, some people might say, wait a minute, these timing attacks, we're talking about nanoseconds of difference, some fraction of a microsecond to see the difference between checking something or not, and there's all this noise in the system. Remember the hardware side channel pictures, there's all this noise that gets added to your timings. Let me give you three responses to this objection. The first response is say, well, okay, maybe timings are noisy, but are you sure that they're noisy enough? Are you sure that somebody can't figure out what's going on here? There's some sort of extra information. And what we've analyzed in the system is the system secure against the attacker sees certain kinds of outputs. We provide input to an authenticated cipher, and we get output from that. And then decryption, we're not supposed to get this side channel information. If you want to guarantee that you've got the same security as what's actually been analyzed, then you must not leak any side channel information. Now, maybe this is excessively formalistic as an answer, so let me give you some maybe more convincing answers. The second one is just like you were seeing for hardware side channels, you average out the noise. Medians may be more robust than averages, but you can easily do whatever statistical attacks to get rid of noise. And you can get rid of the noise. For instance, in the original 1970s attack, they didn't just look at the time for AAA versus secret. What they did was they put the AAA right at a page boundary in the system. So the memory in the system is divided into pages. Nowadays, it might be 4 kilobyte pages. I don't know what it was for 10x. But if you put your AAA right crossing a page boundary, then if the system is looking past that first A, crosses the boundary, then it's loading a new page of memory. And you could set up that next page to actually be non-existent and create a page fault, which you would easily notice, much more easily than just the timing variation from reading memory. So the timing signal would suddenly be amplified massively into something that you could very easily see. And all sorts of modern attacks are doing very similar things to break real systems. I've got a few slides here on defenders don't learn. Let me try to give you some examples of attacks that people have proposed and actually carried out versus some things that defenders have claimed worked. So let's look at some of these details. Okay, first of all, this whole idea of you really care about timing attacks goes back to Paul Kocher. There were some previous exploits of side channel information, but this paper is what really woke people up to the concept of timing information and other side channel information is something which can totally break a cryptographic system, which we don't know how to break in any other way. One thing that he mentioned in that paper and that was also mentioned in this follow-up paper was that if you have a load from memory as opposed to something which obviously takes a different amount of time for, like, if you say, if this matches, then keep looking. If it doesn't match, then stop. That obviously takes a different amount of time, depending how many bytes you're comparing. If you look something up in an array, that might sound like it's taking the same amount of time no matter where you're looking in the array, like you do an SBox lookup in AES. But if you miss the cache, then that's going to take a lot more time. The system optimizes some memory lookups by having a cache of recently used values, and if you use one of those values, it's fast. If you use some other value that's not in the cache, then it's slow. And depending whether there's a cache miss or not, you end up with very different timing behavior, which an attacker could, in principle, observe. Then Dan Page was doing analysis of whether this could happen, and Sunu et al. Actually did real timing attacks against DES. And then you might say, well, easy fix to this is load the whole table into cache. So then you're not going to have any cache misses. You might think that this works, but it doesn't. Because, for example, the timing of loading things from different positions in cache actually depends on which positions you're loading. So this was something which I was pointing out in 2004, is that if you have cache bank collisions, which lots of CPUs will, there's lots of CPUs from Intel Sandy Bridge, for example, you have multiple banks of fast cache memory. And each of those will store some data from your main memory. There will be this fast cache of some data, another fast cache, another bank of cache storing some other data. And any of those you can look up very quickly. And in fact, you can look up two of these items from the cache very quickly. The banks, two of them can give you data at the same time. But if in one cycle you try to grab data from the same bank of the cache, where the bank you're looking at is determined by the address you're trying to look up, then that bank will say, wait a minute, I can only give you one piece of data at a time. So you look something up, and you look something up, and if it's from the same cache bank, it's a little slower, one cycle slower, and if it's from different cache banks, then it's the same speed. And you might say, oh, one cycle, nanosecond or less, you can't notice that, but, well, it turns out you can. I'll get to actual attacks in a moment. What I recommended in that paper was just don't look anything up from secret addresses. And that clearly gets rid of this side channel of information of what array index you're looking at leaking information to the attacker. There's other side channels that affect timing, which I'll get to. Continuing on the story here, the first really scary attack along these lines was from, well, the original paper, I think, was Osvik, Shamir, Tromer. Then the one I'm linking to from these slides is Tromer, Osvik, Shamir. Anyway, whatever set of people there. In 65 milliseconds, using timing of the cache, they extracted the AES key that was being used to encrypt a disk. They weren't breaking into the operating system kernel. They were just doing some disk writes, which were using the AES key, and then, or maybe it was disk reads, I don't remember, and watching the cache behavior, watching the timing of the machine at the same time. And in 65 milliseconds, they figured out what the AES key was. So it's like, as soon as somebody can run a program on your machine for 65 milliseconds, maybe even within your browser, maybe this could even be done within JavaScript, get the same kind of information, then they've got the AES key, and then, okay, that doesn't mean they have the contents of your disk yet. They still have to grab your disk, but now they can decrypt your supposedly encrypted hard drive. Intel is another example of defenders not learning from what papers say. Intel said, well, okay, here's the countermeasure that we'll tell people to put in. When you load data, your memory is organized as 64-byte lines. So your entire RAM is organized as, there's byte 0 through 63, that's one line, then 64 through 127, that's the next line, and so on. And they're copied into cache, preserving that line structure. So the cache is also organized as lines, and lines are always copied around between memory and cache, preserving, like, one entire line is copied. And so what they said is, if you want to look something up, like, imagine an SBox that consists of 64 bytes. What you do is put that into, align it with one line of your cache. And then wherever you're looking in the SBox, you're always grabbing data from that same line, which means it's either all in cache, or if it's not, it all gets copied to cache, and then you look it up from the cache. And then, okay, they thought that would deal with this problem. Peter and I put up some slides while Peter did this web session presentation at CES 2013 saying, nah, here's some sample code which shows that even if everything's in cache, you get variability because of, for example, cache bank collisions. Didn't analyze what exactly the performance was, but just observed experimentally a performance difference, which is explainable from all sorts of documented effect. And then actual attack is called cache bleed. This is from Yaraman, Genkin, and Henninger this year, where they timed OpenSSL with this recommended, Intel recommended countermeasure, code supplied by Chagrin from Intel, which supposedly made OpenSSL constant time. You'll find lots of code labeled constant time, which is doing this, and nevertheless, here comes your RSA secret key to an attacker who's just timing things from one cycle variations in timings. This gets your secret key. So my reaction to this is don't allow any timing variations, but you still get things like 2008, rewinding a bit, but still after lots of papers on timing attacks. The TLS 1.2 standard said, yeah, here's some operation inside. You're receiving a message, and that message has been authenticated and encrypted, and there's some weird thing in TLS where it used to be that TLS would always take a message and then, what order do you do? Encrypt and pad and MAC? I would think you pad the message first, and then you encrypt the result, and then you MAC it, maybe merge the padding with the MAC. But what they did was the MAC on the inside, and then they pad it, and then they encrypt in CBC mode. And they observed, as part of this standard, that there was a timing channel. The MAC performance depends on where the MAC is. So you do some decryption step with data that might be invalid, and then try to unpad it, and then you have a MAC somewhere which is going to be supposedly authenticating some data, where the amount of data being authenticated depends on the position of the MAC, which is saying the length of the data before the MAC. And they said this leaves a small timing channel, since MAC performance depends on the size of the data. But this is not believed to be large enough to be exploitable due to the large block size of existing MACs and the small size of the timing signal. And this is like, you see an action movie, and there's the two guys fighting in the front, and then there's a flash of lightning, and you see a big spike sticking out of a building, and you know something bad is going to happen with that spike. And so sure enough, there was an attack paper. This is the Lucky 13 attack, which exploited exactly these timings. Yes, they're small. Yes, MAC block sizes are pretty big, but nevertheless, it's exploitable, and so they decrypt TLS encrypted data. Okay. Suppose you want to not be faced with these problems. What do you do? Well, there's a little bit of a documentation problem, but let me give you my best advice for dealing with these problems. First of all, try to write your code in assembly language, because if you write your code in assembly language, it might sound scary, but you shouldn't have to write that much crypto code. If you have to write a whole lot of crypto code, you're doing something wrong. So write your code in assembly language, and then you actually know which instructions you're using at each moment. If there were a compiler that gave you serious guarantees of what's going on, then sure, you could, if the compiler is done correctly, then you could write code in whatever language that is. But realistically, right now, you get the best control writing in assembly language. Doesn't mean the assemblers will all do exactly what you expect, but there's a lot less code there for people to screw up. Assemblers tend to be relatively simple objects rather than compilers, which do all sorts of interesting things. Then look at the CPU documentation. And if you see something like this, then pay attention to it. Division operations terminate when the divide operation completes, with the number of cycles required dependent on the values of the input operands. In Intel manuals, this one's from an ARM manual, in Intel manuals you'll see things like how many cycles does this instruction take on this processor? Between 80 and 100. There's obviously some time variability there. Well, okay, maybe they're completely lying to you, but you try out some divisions, and yeah, depending how big the numbers are that you're dividing, you get variable times. One of the fixes for this attack, one of the pieces of code that was supposed to do constant time verification of TLS decryption, unfortunately, that piece of code was using division operations and had to have an emergency patch for undoing that and not using division operations. And that was from Adam Langley, who is fairly experienced crypto implementer. And nevertheless, well, if you don't know that something like division takes variable time, then you can easily make a mistake there. So pay attention to the manuals when they say something takes variable time, without trusting the manuals necessarily. If the manual says this takes one cycle, And maybe it doesn't actually always take exactly one cycle. Try measuring it. Try breaking that. See if you can actually find some timing variation in this supposedly constant time software. What the results tend to look like of acquiring this information is that you should write code as follows. This is the meta information of how you should figure out what to do. That's more important than these details, but here's what the details end up looking like. First of all, don't use any secret branch conditions. Don't have code that says if the secret bit is 0, do this, if the secret bit is 1, do that. There's all sorts of leaks there. Don't even try doing it. Don't try doing secret array indices, any sort of memory location. The address should be something totally public. You should never put on the hardware address bus. You should never have any secret data. There are some CPUs where you can maybe occasionally violate this and not get in trouble, but it's so hard to get it right. It's so hard to control what platforms you're running on. It's best to just not use any secret array indices. So if you're going to do an AES implementation, do a bit slice. Don't do it as S boxes or T boxes in RAM or ROM. Cutting off data flow to variable rotation distances. Sometimes you have a cipher where you've got some variable rotations depending on secrets. You can do something like that. You can simulate it with constant time, several constant time shifts and conditions. But if you just do it in the simple way as a variable rotation, that will, on lots of processors, take a variable amount of time. Sometimes it'll be constant time, but again, trying to control where the code is running is a royal pain. So safest thing to do is just not do variable shifts, variable rotates. If you can do ands and ors and XORs, or shifting by a constant distance, you want your bits to talk to each other, rotates, those are basically always fine. You can imagine how somebody could make those go in variable time, but if somebody has, say, 32 bits or even 16 bits XORed with another 16 bits, they're not going to be thinking something like, oh, maybe somebody's dividing a small number by a small number, I should make that go fast. They're going to be thinking, oh, I've got 32 random bits and 32 random bits and just XOR them together, and the CPU implementer is not going to be trying to optimize that. It's already super fast to do logic, and there's very few cases where they'll think, oh, I'm going to try to optimize that case. For essentially the same reason, vector instructions, vector arithmetic, almost always runs in constant time. Simple if you do vector additions, for example. Vector bit operations. I mean, logic instructions are vectors, like 32 ands, 32 ors. That's an example of a vector instruction. More generally, any kind of operations on labeled as vector operations. CPU manufacturers, if you do some fancy thing like a vector table lookup from memory, maybe that'll take variable time. But vector arithmetic, that's going to take constant time. Multiplication is a tricky case. There's lots of operations, like if you're doing universal hashing, low collision probability hashing, using integer multiplications, then you really have to watch out if that code runs on some small devices like a Cortex-M3 or typical PowerPC, then those will try to optimize the multiplications. They'll say, if the thing you're multiplying by is 0, try to make that go fast, or if it's smaller than usual. They try to optimize the multiplications in lots of ways, and most bigger chips will say multiplications are just always reasonably fast. Vector multiplications, those will always be constant time. But these are smaller chips which don't have vector operations, and the multiplications are not always super fast. If you multiply, say, a 16-bit number by a 16-bit number, that'll be faster than multiplying by a full 32-bit number. It's hard to deal with this if you really want to use multiplications for speed and you don't want to rewrite it as logic operations and you want to run on these processors, or you have code which might be running on these processors, then it's scary. You will get variable time performance out of the multipliers. All right, I mentioned performance, and that'll be the thing I focus on for the rest of the talk. If you don't have to worry about performance, which most of the time you don't have to worry about, then just use logic operations for everything. It's like design hardware to do your cipher, and that hardware consists of, in the end, transistors, which are NANDs, and then just do the same NANDs in software or whatever combination of ands and ors. And if you don't care about performance, just do everything bit sliced as logic operations, and you're done. Your code works, it's constant time, and then easy to test. It's slower than it could be. The general statement on the slide is that almost all software is slower, much slower than it could be. But does it actually matter? Most of the time, the answer is that software that you're writing doesn't actually get applied to that much data. I mean, most of the things your computer is doing, it's like some data comes in, it's processed by some software, but is the software actually consuming a lot of CPU time? Only if you have a lot of data coming in to a lot of computers, which are spending a lot of time on that data. That's when you care about performance. But most software is not like that, so don't worry about software performance unless you have to. The thing about crypto is that secret key crypto, secret key encryption, and authentication in particular, that's something that we want to have applied to every network packet, every piece of communication. And even if you think, well, I'm not actually downloading that much data, maybe you want to have your RAM encrypted, like the SGX discussion a few days ago. All sorts of communication, you can avoid trusting the network, avoid trusting your disk, avoid trusting your memory if you're encrypting everything. And that's actually a whole lot of data. That's something which scales as we use our computers more and more, as we have more and more communication that we do, and we want all that communication to be encrypted and authenticated. If you have your crypto being too slow, and it's crypto that's being used in bulk, like secret key, typical secret key operations, then you lose some low end, some users who don't have a lot of CPU time to spare. They're going to say, no, sorry, I can't use your crypto. And the nasty thing that happens is even the other users who are, they have enough time to use your crypto, they don't like it so much. Because when you have fewer people using it, if you lose the low end, then you lose a bunch of cryptanalysts. The cryptanalyst would rather be targeting something that has a chance of being a standard for everybody, something that is, you know, like AES runs on lots of different platforms and runs at reasonable speed. If you have something which is too slow to run on a microcontroller, then there's going to be cryptanalysts who say, yeah, that's not going to turn into a universal standard like AES. I'd rather analyze AES. And then when you have less cryptanalysis, then other people will say, how much has this been studied? Yeah, I can run it. I've got a big laptop or a big server, and I don't have that much data. I can use your crypto that's too slow for other people, but it hasn't been studied so much. Everybody's happier if you have crypto which is fast enough for everybody to use, and then the cryptanalysts say, hey, that actually has a chance of being the standard important thing to analyze, and then having more cryptanalysis makes everybody happier with your crypto. So as a result of this kind of thought process, there's lots of people who are interested in how fast crypto is. Let me dig into some examples of the following situation. You've got a cipher or hash function, whatever authenticator that you care about. You want to know how fast is the cipher on this machine. You want it to be as fast as it possibly can be. So you want to create software. You don't just want to have the answer. You don't want to just assert, yes, it can run at this speed. You want to convince everybody so that you're going to get people saying, yeah, that's a good fast cipher, and let's study that and get everybody using it. All right, so cipher X, you want it running fast. You have some software for it already, some reference implementation. You do something nice and simple, easy to understand, which is saying how X works. And then you pick your CPU, or you pick 10 CPUs, but let's just take one at a time. I'll pick a particular one in a moment for an example. And then you see how fast your reference software is, and it runs in this many cycles. Okay, now what do you do? What does that number of cycles mean? Well, let's look at an actual example. So here's a really high security authenticator of an array of 1,000 integers. The target platform here is a TI chip because TI has this habit of sending me low-cost development boards to play with. This is a TI Stellaris launchpad. If anybody happens to have one of those, it has this particular CPU on it, long name. What matters for optimizing is the CPU core inside it, which was designed by ARM, so Cortex M4F CPU core. And the particular software here, all right, you've had time at this point to absorb how this message authenticator works. It takes each element of the X array, X0 through X, 999, adds them all up to something in terms of zero, so the sum of the 1,000 elements of the X-array, all right, maybe it's not that high security, but it's not actually so different from what crypto software has to do, right? We'll look at a more sophisticated example after this. All right, to count the number of cycles, there's something machine-specific, and I'm not going to go through this. There's various libraries. It's not hard to find how you figure out how many cycles it takes to get data out of a microcontroller. There might be weird function calls. Actually, any small scale, like Cortex-M3, Cortex-M4, exactly this code will work, unless the CPU manufacturer was a serious cheapskate and turned off the cycle counter. But it's usually not hard to count the number of cycles inside whatever piece of code. And then, okay, you do that for this piece of code on that CPU, and it says 8,012. Sum, whatever the sum is, and 8,012 is the difference between the cycle counter before and after the code. Cycle counter just counts up from zero when you start it. If you do 500 loops instead of 1,000 loops, then it's 4,012 cycles. Okay, clearly it's 8 cycles per time through this loop, and then there's 12 cycles of stuff around it somehow. Checking the cycle counter, calling the function, setting up the result, whatever stuff around is obviously 12 cycles, and each time through the 1,000 times through the loop is 8 cycles. All right, your first reaction might be, okay, it's a microcontroller, it's a small CPU, it's running at 80 megahertz, and maybe it takes a tenth of a microsecond to add some stuff. Maybe, sounds plausible. You might say, well, okay, maybe I didn't write the code very well. Maybe I should do something. Maybe I should say register result instead of just saying int result. Or maybe I should unroll the loop or use GCC -03 -F schedule instance something or other. And then, okay, you just try optimizing. And if you do this, you'll probably find, yeah, you can get better results than 8,000 cycles. And then at some point, well, you run out of ideas for speeding it up, and you don't. It seems like you've got the best results. This is not what I recommend. This is not how you're going to get the software running really fast. This, well, if you get lucky, maybe this will give you optimal results. But here's what you should do. This is actually much more satisfying. It's going to get you the best results, and you'll be confident about it. You won't waste time doing it. What you should do is figure out how many cycles does this CPU actually need to do the arithmetic that you want to do and whatever operations you need to do. And then understand why your code is not running at that speed. So let's dig into how this happens. And obviously, once you understand it, then you deal with it and you make your code run at the desired speed. So here's what this looks like for this CPU. You look around online. And it's a little weird. There's some documentation for an M4 processor, and then there's this M4F. And eventually you look on Wikipedia, which says an M4F is the same as an M4 and has a floating point unit. That's what the F is an FPU, a floating point unit, attached to the M4. But the CPU core runs all the instructions at the same speed. It would be more convincing if there were, from ARM, a Cortex M4F technical reference manual. But it seems to me like ARM has actually moved away from the M4F terminology. They want people calling these an M4, whereas TI is like, wait, M4F is better than just an M4, so we should sell an M4F. Okay, you get past this terminological problem. This is the right manual for this processor, the Cortex M4 processor technical reference manual, which says that this implements a particular instruction set, particular architecture profile called ARMv7e-M. Whatever that means. Okay, this manual also tells you where to find documentation. It says this is documented in the ARMv7-M architecture reference manual. Okay, so download that, read through it. It's only 700 something pages, which are telling you here's the instructions supported by this processor and all sorts of other things that you don't need to know. And it's alphabetized, so you pretty quickly find add as doing 32-bit addition. That's one of the basic instructions supported by the processor. And then you go back to the M4 manual, and it says add takes 1 cycle, which sounds a lot different from 8 cycles. So what's going on with this code? That's actually a very big gap. This is making it sound like it should be 1,000 cycles, not 8,000 cycles. Well, if you read the description of add more carefully, then you see that what this 32-bit addition is able to do is take register inputs and produce a register output. So this processor has 16 integer registers. Each one is 32 bits. And these registers are, well, okay, you were hearing before in the hardware talk about flip-flops versus SRAM banks versus shift registers. Registers for CPU designers are typically going to be SRAM banks, where the SRAM banks, you can grab a register from that bank, and then, well, there's 16 32-bit registers, and what the add instruction does is it takes one of these 16 registers, you can pick which one, and then takes another one, adds them together, and puts the results on top of into another register. It's a little less flexible. I was mentioning in the context of designing a 384-bit permutation, you don't actually get to use all 16 registers, because one of them is your program counter, saying which instruction you're going to do next. It's really hard to store data there. Another one is a stack pointer. If you're totally in control of your system, you don't need the stack pointer, but it's really hard to engineer software that way. So realistically, you can't use more than 14 registers for software that people are going to use. Okay. This add instruction, before it can process the 1,000 elements of the X-array, it has to put those into registers. And that's not something the add will do. That's another instruction, a load. Load is copying from memory to a register. And eventually you find in this architecture reference manual, you find there's a load instruction, LDR, that copies from RAM to the registers. Now the manual, the M4 manual, says that LDR takes 2 cycles. But then there's a note next to that which says, well, LDR will sometimes be pipelined under the following restrictions, odd even addresses, blah, 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 blah. And then you keep reading and you find something saying, all right, if there's an LDR, a load instruction, copying from the X-array into registers, and then another LDR as the next instruction, then the second LDR takes only 1 cycle. So if you do 2 loads in a row, then the first one takes 2 cycles, the next one takes 1 cycle. What's happening internally is there's 2 stages to a load. There's figuring out the address, computing the address to load from, which can be adding up a base address and an integer, or adding 2 registers to each other. That produces the address to load data from. And that takes the first cycle. And then the second cycle actually copies data from memory. If you have 2 loads in a row, then the processor is smart enough to say, I'll reuse the circuitry for the figuring out the address while the copy from memory is happening. So the first load is doing those 2 cycles, and the second load already during the second cycle starts figuring out its address. So the second load only takes 1 cycle instead of 2 cycles. And you can do this for a whole sequence of loads in a row. There's eventually some comment. You have to see all these comments, and also not all the comments in the manuals are correct, but well, these particular comments in this manual all seem to be correct. If you have n loads in a row, then that will take n plus 1 cycles. Each one will overlap 1 cycle with the previous. So you have a total of n plus 1 cycles to load n chunks of n 32-bit words and 32-bit integers from the X array into registers. With a limit of, you only have 14, well, 16 minus those 2 special ones. Actually, it's even another special one, the link register, but that's much easier to reuse. Let's say 14 is a limit. You can load 14 things into those 14 registers and then do something with them. That only takes 15 cycles instead of 2 times 14. Okay, there's also some other instructions. If you keep reading the manual, there's actually a whole bunch of instructions. Processors would say we have a reduced instruction set, very few instructions. They're going to have actually a ton of instructions. And sometimes they're useful, and I won't get into the details of these because they don't seem to be faster on the CPU than using a bunch of LDRs. All right, putting this together, copying n chunks of data from the X-array, loading them into these 16 registers, assuming n is small enough, and then doing n additions into the output, that takes a total of 2n plus 1 cycles. Okay, so the 1,000 is going to take more than 2,000 cycles, where half of that is arithmetic, and well, a little less than half is arithmetic, and the rest of it is loading, just copying data from memory. Why did we have 8,000 instead of 2,000-something cycles? There's a few different reasons. One of them is that the compiler is doing something like load, add, load, add, load, add. And what the manual says is if the next instruction after a load is another load, that second load gets faster. So if you do load, load, add, add, it's faster than load, add, load, add because of this pipeline, something happening at the same time. There's also that I, the loop counter, going from 0 to 1,000. You have to add 1 to it, check if it's still less than 1,000, and branch back to the top of the loop most of the time. And just those simple loop control operations take a few more cycles. So what the compiler ends up doing is something like 2 cycles for load, 1 cycle for an add, 5 cycles for other overhead, and that adds up to the 8 cycles for the loop, which is much, much worse than 2 or 2 plus epsilon. All right, once you've read the manuals, once you've got this understanding of what's going on, then it's clear how to write the code to make it go much, much faster. And you end up with something that looks much more like this. You have, say, 10 things you're going to load. The start of the code here is x0 is pickup x bracket 0 written in a way which is, if you do more assembly, you start thinking like this. X1 is x bracket 1. The volatile there is a hint to the compiler, which it won't necessarily follow. In assembly, you get much more control. But in C, you will often be able to convince the compiler to do a load right at the moment you've said, if you say volatile. So you load x0 through x6, and it's going to be 10 x's being loaded. Maybe you could get away with one or two more. Maybe I should also say the index variable I has changed now. X is going to move along through the position of the original, from the original position to the end, and the end position is stored in a y variable. All right, load a bunch of x's, and then add each of those into the result, and now thinking cycles, each of these 10 loads should take 1 cycle, except the first one took an extra. So 11 cycles for the 10 loads, and then 10 cycles for the 10 adds, and then let's do it again to reduce the cost of loop control. So do reuse the x0 through x9 to load the next 10 spots in the x array. Move the x pointer along by 20 positions, 80 bytes in the array, and then add in the x's into the result, return the result. And now instead of 8,000 cycles, this is much more tolerable, 2,500 cycles.
What about the code size now?
The code size is significantly worse. On this processor, there's something like 256K of RAM that you can work with, which if you're trying to do crypto and a bunch of other stuff, then yeah, if you expand code like this, then it's a serious problem. And you have to balance that against lots of other pieces of code. This particular effect, so unrolling code like this, in cryptographic context, you tend to have inner loops which are big enough anyway that a little bit of unrolling, it's not like you should be imagining like 100 or 300 lines of crypto code times the expansion that you see here. It's more like maybe you take the 300 lines and turn it into 600 lines and say that's already pretty big. It's definitely an issue that you're bringing up, and it's to be balanced against other issues. Okay, if you write the same kind of thing in assembly and know a little more about the instruction set, you can save some of the instructions. You can also unroll it more and save more time. I should compare this to a quote on Wikipedia, which says, by the late 1990s, this is in the Optimizing Compilers webpage, by the late 1990s, for even performance-sensitive code, optimizing compilers exceeded the performance of human experts. Now, to give Wikipedia some credit, I was making fun of this quote in a talk April 16th, 2015. And on April 18th, somebody put the reaction, which was, well, my first reaction, which is citation needed. But they didn't actually fix it. So Wikipedia still has this bogus claim about optimizing compilers. I mean, here it's 3 times faster compared to the original code. Tried a bunch of different compiler options. The one thing that does save time from the original code is telling GCC explicitly unroll the loop. That saves some time, but it's still like twice the number of cycles of writing the code a little differently. Okay. I promised there would be a real example. Let me see how I'm doing on time. Okay. Suppose you take, I made some random choice of cipher here, take the reference software for the Salsa 20 cipher and run it on the same Cortex-M4F CPU core, then it takes 30.25 cycles per byte. Let's compare that to the arithmetic. In Salsa 20, there's 20 rounds, and each round, each 32-bit chunk that you're working with involves an add and an XOR, and there's also some add at the end for feed forward, and so a total of 21 times 16 adds, each of which takes one cycle according to the manual, and 20 times 16 XORs, which also take one cycle according to the manual, and that's for handling 64 bytes of data. So let's see, 20 times 16 divided by 64 sounds like 5 cycles per byte plus 5.25 cycles per byte, total of 10.25 cycles per byte for the arithmetic that Solve2Swan needs to do. And now you say, wait a minute, what about those rotations? There's also, it's not just adds and XORs, that wouldn't be secure, we also need rotations, but the nice thing about most ARMs is that you can do rotations for free. So if you look at the instruction set, then the definition of the XOR instruction, the add instruction, lots of arithmetic instructions allow you to rotate an input with no extra cost. While the instruction set manual tells you that you can do this as part of the instruction, and the M4 manual tells you on the M4, it's still one cycle to do an XOR over rotated value. Okay, so this is something where you don't actually need to read the manual. If you look at the assembly language produced by the compiler, use GCC minus capital S, for example, and you'll see that there's some funky XOR rotate instruction in some weird language, which, well, it's not nice to learn the language of these instruction set manuals, but you can learn to decipher it, and then you see the compiler actually does this automatically. So the compiler actually does exactly this arithmetic inside the reference implementation for Solve2Swan. But somehow it ends up taking 30 cycles per byte instead of 10 cycles per byte, and that's a pretty significant slowdown. So you dig into what's going on in this reference implementation, what happens if you change the number of rounds, which functions are taking the time, and then quickly realize that some auxiliary functions, load little endian and store little endian, those are actually taking a significant chunk of that 30 cycles per byte. So what those functions are doing, it's what the name sounds like, but in more detail, it's taking 32 bits as 4 bytes in a standard order, little endian order, and taking the first byte and the next byte times 256 and the next byte times 256 squared and the next byte times 256 cubed, adding those together or ORing those together. That's what load little endian does, and store little endian does the opposite, copying a 32-bit integer to memory in a standard order, which you could think of as just load an int from memory or store an int to memory. But if you want portable code, which the reference implementation is, that would work on some machine where ints are stored the other way around, or maybe in some funky order, then you have to write some code which looks like this, load little endian, store little endian. And then the compiler doesn't recognize that that is doing something where there's just an instruction in the instruction set. LDR does exactly what load little endian does. There's an STR, store instruction, store register, which does exactly what store little endian does. But the compiler's too stupid to figure that out. So, okay, replace it yourself. Say this is storing an int and loading an int. And then that drops the 30 cycles per byte down to 23 cycles per byte, of which 18 cycles per byte are spent on 10 cycles per byte. The 10 lower bound for the arithmetic actually is taking 18 cycles per byte. If you change the number of rounds from 20 to 40, then you see this number. And then there's some overhead of the remainder, 23 minus 18, 5 cycles per byte, is setting up and concluding, which is very cheap in Solve2Swan. The conclusion is 0.25 cycles per byte, and the setting up is just copying data around, and somehow that ends up taking 5 cycles per byte. So the total time here, there's still quite a gap, even after this one fix to how the loads and stores are done. There's quite a bit of overhead inside the rounds and outside the rounds for Solve2Swan. Most of that time is being spent on loads and stores. Essentially all of the gap is explained by the compiler is picking up data, storing it somewhere else, picking up more data, storing it somewhere else. And this happens most importantly inside the rounds, this 18 cycles per byte where the arithmetic takes 10. That's happening because the 16 32-bit words in Solve2Swan plus the 17th word needed for temporary storage, that doesn't fit into 14 registers. And that is entirely what makes the performance difference between 10 and 18. Okay, there's also the extra stuff, which is also the compiler loading and storing things. If you want this to run faster, then you have to choose where do you exactly what do you spill, which means exactly if you imagine you had many registers, as many as you want, which is 17 for salsa 20, and you then say, oh, oops, we only have 14. That means you've got some extra registers spilling off the edge. So sometimes you have to put some data into RAM. And then that's called a spill. And then you copy it back into registers before you use it. And if you choose exactly what that pattern is and put loads consecutively, because that makes the loads run faster, then that reduces the cost of doing the loads and stores inside this inner loop. You have to make some decisions here, and all of these are things where you can't trust the compiler to be doing. For instance, you have to decide out of the 16 state words in salsa 20, 16 32-bit words, which of those should be in registers at each moment. And that's something which interacts with the structure of salsa 20 to make the right decision in a way which is not obvious to the compiler. The compiler will make some sort of random decision of what to spill and not do a very good job of it. This loads consecutive, well, I've mentioned that issue before, and that's something the compiler just gets totally wrong. You can't trust the compiler to decide where your registers are going to be used, and you can't trust it to decide which order to put the instructions in. You also can't trust your compiler to choose the right instructions. I mentioned before that this chip has a floating point unit, and that actually has its own set of registers and some way to copy from the integer registers to the floating point registers, which looks like it's faster than doing storing to memory, loading from memory, storing to memory. I only plugged in the Stellaris board last week, so I haven't actually had time to finish doing this, but I suspect this will give the fastest code. You can't trust the compiler to figure out something like this. It's just going to say, oh yeah, all of the variables are stored in RAM. I don't know how to do anything else, like use other registers which might be available on the CPU. Another example of instruction selection, if you have a smartphone CPU, it's going to have vector instructions or neon instructions. Using those instructions, working with 128 bits of arithmetic instead of 32 bits of arithmetic, that is going to make things go much, much faster. Even if those instructions take two cycles instead of one, you're still getting a factor of two speed up in your arithmetic, and that makes things run much, much faster as long as your data is organized in a way which is compatible with the vector instructions. Okay. Sometimes people ask me, how did I predict in 2004, 2005 that the salsa 20 design would keep running faster and faster on new CPUs? And there's no secret to that. You can look at what CPU designers are thinking. In the second hour of my talk, I've got some more slides which are saying what the CPU designer is thinking. It's actually a predictable thing, and I'll give you the summary on this slide, and then stop. You can see what the pressures are on CPU designers and what that makes them do in instruction sets as CPUs get bigger and bigger. My examples have been for a small CPU. But as CPUs get bigger and faster, then these pressures tell you that CPUs are going to do certain things, which you can then write your cryptographic software to use. For instance, vectorization. Let me start with the small things you have to watch out for if you want your crypto to run fast. First of all, there's pipelining. This is this issue of sometimes instructions are going to overlap. As the processors get bigger and bigger, there's going to be more of this. There's going to be more times when you have to have like one instruction started and then the same resources used by that instruction, which can go for several cycles, they can start being used by another instruction as long as the instructions are arranged in a way that the CPU recognizes are independent and can both reuse those same resources. Superscalar processing, this is where you have a CPU that can do two instructions, three instructions, four instructions, or more per cycle instead of just one instruction per cycle or maybe taking multiple cycles. These things, you have to read the instruction set documentation, and you can predict how these are going to evolve with processors getting bigger, understand how much parallelism to expect out of the instruction sets that CPU designers are putting into their chips. And then the bigger things to worry about, I've listed several things here, which if you want to go further into the future and say, how am I going to have my code running really fast on chips in 5 years, 10 years, then you have to watch out for the following things. First of all, obviously, vectorization. If you have your code, if you have your data laid out in a way which lets you say, I'm going to pick up 128, 256, 512 bits, add them or XOR them, whatever simple operation with another vector of that size, that is going to scale to future processors in a way that just working with a few bits at a time will not. Many threads, many cores, obviously we're getting more and more cores on our chips. And if you have a suitable node which can handle splitting your computations across a bunch of separate CPU cores, then you can take advantage of this. Obviously, a lot of these for the cipher designer end up just saying, do a parallelizable mode, and then you'll be prepared for the future. But that also interacts with how you handle individual blocks to make it run really fast. The ring and the mesh, I think I won't be able to explain without some pictures in my other slides, so I'll skip those. But in general, you should worry about how parallel things are, how much communication you have between different parts of a big message state or multiple messages that you're handling. How much can you do independently on different parts of your state and not have to talk to the other parts? And if you pay attention to how CPUs are actually moving this in these directions, then you can make your code run fast, even on CPUs quite a few years into the future. That's it. Thanks for your attention.